really our task, it's always making sure that these millions of ski tourers worldwide today, they are able to make informed decisions. Some of them even didn't appreciate very much that there was suddenly an electronic engineer who told them how to hold the shovel and how to move the snow. My name is Manuel Genswein, and you're listening to the Avalanche Hour podcast.
You're tuned in to another episode of the Avalanche Hour podcast, your source for great conversations within the snow and avalanche community. I'm your host, Matthias Walcher, from the Austrian Association for Snow and Avalanches. The Avalanche Hour podcast is proudly presented by Wissen Avalanche Control, safety for innovation. With additional support from Gordini, we keep you outside longer. And Open Snow. Visit opensnow.com to get started with a free trial and enter the discount code AVALANCHEPODCAST at checkout to receive 30% off your first year of Open Snow All Access. The goal of this podcast is to create a stronger community through the sharing of stories, knowledge and news amongst people who have a curious fascination with avalanches. Hi everybody and welcome to episode number 2 from Austria, Europe. Thank you for joining me today. We are entering spring season here in the Alps. The valleys are green, birds are singing, bees are flying, and even the apricot trees are blossoming. But there's still a lot of snow in the Alpine, south and north of the main ridge here in Austria. There's more than in an average year. So hopefully we will get some corn skiing in spring. Seems like we have a good chance of some more pretty decent skiing conditions. Anyway, today the president of the ÖXL, the Austrian Association for Snow and Avalanches, Christoph Mitterer, sits down with me for an interview with Manuel Genswein. And we jump in right away, I would say, and enjoy the interview. Yeah, hi and welcome to the Avalanche Hour podcast. Today with me is my co-host, Christoph Mitterer. Christoph is an avalanche forecaster at the Avalanche Warning Service in Tyrol. He is also the president of the Austrian Association for Snow and Avalanches, and I'm very happy to have him here again in our show. He has been co-hosting an episode with me before. And last season, we talked a lot about the conditions in the Alps. We skipped this part today because we have a very interesting guest today. So first of all, welcome, Christoph. Thank you for joining me today.
Hey, Matthias. Thanks for having me. It's really an honor and a pleasure to be with you on this podcast. And it's also an honor for me to kind of introduce our guest. Many of your listeners might have come across his name. He's a native of the Swiss Alps with a huge background in electronic engineering. He has developed avalanche rescue products and techniques that have been applied around the world. So probably one of you listeners or every one of you listeners have or has used his work, and his work involved a lot of traveling, so maybe one or the other of you have seen him since he has done snow safety work in more than 30 countries around the world.
On our show today is Manuel Genswein. He is currently working, as funny as it might sound, as an intern with us with the Avalanche Warning Service in Tyrol. We are very happy that you make part of our pack this season, Manuel, and we are very pleased that you are that you followed our invitation and you're on the podcast with us today. Hey, welcome, Manuel.
Thank you very much, Matthias. Thank you very much, Christoph, for the invitation and for the nice introduction to this podcast.
Welcome also from my side, Manuel. And of course, first things first, most important thing, what is your current ski touring setup?
My current ski touring setup is a Atomic ski, 100 millimeters wide with Fritchie pin binding with a side release, and I just thought in the main winter season it's a good balance between an off-floating but still suitable for ski touring. So everything which is too wide for these traverses when it is harder and so on, then you know that the 130s are maybe a little bit too much. Towards the spring, I usually change to a slightly narrower ski. But yes, I think around 100 millimeters. So for a versatile winter snowpack ski, this Atomic 100 millimeter ski is quite suitable for my needs and my ski abilities.
Especially in the Alps, the snow can be very variable, so I think that's a really good choice, an all-rounder, so to say. Where did you find the best snow in your past 30 years traveling around different mountain regions?
If I would have to make a bet for where to find best snow, I would most definitely say Hokkaido, the northern island of Japan. It's just the entire setup with how these fronts move in. Picking up the very cold air over these huge plains of northern China and Mongolia, then slowly moving over them, the sea, and slowly starting to snow out over Hokkaido and the main island of Japan. It's probably one of the most productive powder creation machines. And I was always fascinated about the fact that it can snow for so long, really days and days and days in a row, without too much wind. You know, as well, here in the Swiss Alps, you have these intense snowfalls. But when it just snows for 4.5 days in a row, and it keeps snowing day and night, and you realize as well that the population there is so adapted to it that in a multi-million city like Sapporo, it can snow 1 meter overnight, and in the morning the traffic runs again completely without any problem, that you have these very special towers to indicate to the snowblower where the edge of the road is. And whereas here in the European Alps, you maybe have a stick which is 2 or 3 meters high on some of the very exposed mountain passes with a lot of snowdrift, you have some maybe 8 meter high poles. But on Hokkaido, you have almost towers which we use in Switzerland for the lightning of the streets, and on these huge towers they mount an arrow which points to the edge of the to the border of the road, so that they see where it stops. So it's absolutely incredible. You have in certain parts on Hokkaido the buildings where the winter entry of the house is in the first floor. And they all construct the houses so there's a second winter entry, full door, on the first floor. Because otherwise, you know, even when you are a pretty decent shoveler and you got through my program, you have no chance to get to the summer entry. So yes, this is, if you really want to see excellent powder snow, I would say second part of January somewhere on Hokkaido is a good bet. Huh?
And language aside, would that also be your favorite place? If you had to pick a place where you would like to stay for the rest of your life, or where would that be?
Yeah, to be very honest, when it is about really living permanently in a place, then obviously very many other factors come into play. And I almost feel a little bit ashamed to admit it, but, you know, after 30 years in 32 nations, I'm not so Swiss anymore, and the Swiss don't perceive me so much as Swiss anymore, and they in fact don't often give me quite a hard time for this. But I'm quite happy about Switzerland, huh? Because looking at a lot of change concerning culture, concerning language, concerning the different eating cultures in a very small radius. Switzerland is a great place. We have the French influence, we have the Italian influence, we have the Swiss-German influence, we have the Retro-Romanic influence. You can do a mountain bike tour of a single day and you cross through three different nations with three languages, with three different culinary styles. I can do a ski tour in the morning on the glacier, and if I sit in the car at midday, I can take a swim in the Mediterranean Sea in the later afternoon. So I think to have so many different cultures, different landscapes on such a small scale, this is really fascinating about the core parts of the European Alps in general, and Switzerland in particular. And when you grew up in Switzerland, you as well, to be honest, really like the idea about a true direct democracy where the citizens are not just delegating power, but you really realize that you are part of the system, and you are not just electing people who then take decisions on behalf of you over 4 years, but they need to ask you multiple times a year if we should go to the left or to the right or straight ahead, or you can make initiatives and you can really influence where the nation you are part of, the society you are part of, is going to. And yeah, there are simply not so many nations in the world which are based on such a direct democratic system. And overall, especially in today's world where, as well politically, it gets very tight, you have in many nations a certain radicalization of the political discussion. I'm in fact happy to be based in Switzerland and to have a very sound culture of compromise where giving in is as well not seen as you have lost it, but it's a compromise which has developed over hundreds of years of closely together living different cultures, which just realized living together means sometimes you get something from the others, but sometimes you need as well to give in some thing. And this richness of culture makes us, in fact, as well quite productive and quite creative. I think having the base of creativity of different languages, different cultures, is really an enrichment for a society. It brings you further. And when you read, for example, a book like Why Switzerland, which analyzes a little bit why we are a particularly creative society, I think it brings back many of these points. It's written by a US sociology professor, by the way. And yes, so even though I'm not perceived very much as a Swiss anymore, if I would have to decide where to live for the rest of my life, Switzerland would be very much on the top of the list.
Yeah, Manuel, so if you as a plant grow a lot through all different countries, you probably will come back to your roots again, I guess. But tell us a little bit about yourself and your roots. Where did you grow up in Switzerland? And of course, we want to know what was your first contact with the topic we want to talk about today with you. What was your first contact with snow and especially avalanches?
I first grew up quite close to Zurich in a place called Zollikon. And then we moved to the Engadin Valley close to St. Moritz for 2 years, where I went as well for 1 year to kindergarten. My dad was responsible for the local reconvalescence hospital. After 2 years, we moved back to a place in Meilen, again closer to Zurich. We then had a holiday home in St. Antonien, one of the villages in the Swiss Alps, which was very much influenced by avalanches in the early days, but as well in the big disasters in the 1950s. It's as well one of the villages which has the longest avalanche protecting structures of Switzerland. So a real a community which really has learned to live in avalanche country. We made as well close ties with the local population. I helped for 9 years on a mountain farm. I have a godchild who lives there, who is now taking over the mountain farm. So I always kept close contact with the society. A few years ago, one of their houses, the farmhouse and the barn, got destroyed by an exceptional avalanche event. The house, which was built in the 1500s, so a very, very old house. And then as well, seeing the aspect of how an avalanche not only influences a recreational activity in a very negative way, but house gets destroyed, an entire livelihood in a certain way gets destroyed, and what it means for a family having to rebuild all that in a valley where basically, when you think about the picture of hazard mapping, there are not many spots where you can build houses and so on. So it showed me as well in the long run an interesting aspect you don't often see when you think about avalanches. Then my dad took me to the first ski tours when I was 5 years old. And I remember that the skis felt very, very heavy. And there are obviously no ski touring bindings for kids, especially not for kids of this age, and especially not for individuals who are so short on the top of it. So there were special inserts you did put into the regular ski bindings, which made it then possible to lift the heel. And after 2 years, there was a new model where you could even modify it so that when it was steep, you could flap up a part at the very end so that the angle in your heel was a little bit more sustainable. So it was really, I really started quite young, and I remember there were no kids except of me on all these mountain tours. But we did it, and it brought me very early in contact with ski touring. We mainly ski toured in the Alps of Glarus, which was about 1 hour of drive, or 45 minutes to 1 hour of driving from where we lived. And then in Graubünden, so mainly in eastern Switzerland. Later on, I then joined the youth section of the Swiss Alpine Club. And in Switzerland, these youth sections of the Swiss Alpine Clubs, they really make a huge contribution to bringing up the next generation of Swiss ski tourers and Swiss mountaineers. And it's a subsidized program by the Swiss Federal Department of Sports. So basically, you have as well mountain guides who train the young generation. Then there's an excellent program to become a youth group guide. And we really made big ski tours on 3,000, 4,000 meter peaks at a very young age. And I remember very well from this generation, which was at this youth club section, many of us later became either mountain guides or work today for the Swiss Institute for Snow and Avalanche Research, or work today at higher positions in the Swiss Alpine Club, or are responsible for some of these mobile Swiss mapping apps. So these youth sections of the Alpine Clubs, they are really a little bit the birthplace of the next generation of mountain professionals, independently if they go towards the direction of guiding or avalanche forecasting or ski patrolling, the many aspects of professional activities in the mountains. Mm-hmm.
Early on, you mentioned Werner Munter. I think he has been, or he is a friend of yours. Tell us a little bit about this connection between Werner Munter and you. And for American listeners, Werner Munter is a mountain guide and a very well-known avalanche professional, I would say, who especially in the German speaking part of the Alps, but Manuel could probably say more about Werner Munter, and if he is also well known in North America or somewhere else. I'm not really sure about that.
Yes, he is, and he is most well known in all English speaking countries due to the Munter Hitch, because Werner was the one who really promoted at big scale that dynamic approach to securing people in rock climbing. And outside of the German-speaking world, in all English-speaking countries, they called this daily used hitch the Munter Hitch. So most people abroad know Werner most because they use the Munter Hitch. And that shows as well that Werner was a very talented person in many different subjects, an innovator and free thinker who very quickly saw where something could still need optimization or where something really was strongly suboptimal. And therefore, he not only brought novel know-how and by the time very new ideas to the snow and avalanche and in particular risk management world, but as well to completely different domains like rock climbing. Yes, Werner and I worked for the first 8 years of my occupational activity in this domain very, very closely together, because immediately after doing these courses in the armed forces, I was approached if I would be interested to revise all the snow, avalanche and risk management teaching materials of the Swiss Alpine Club and the Swiss Federal Department of Sports. And I was very interested and decided to take on this job. And Werner then very soon joined the Swiss Snow and Avalanche Research Institute, and we worked for very many years very closely together on this project. And Werner was not so good in foreign languages, so we traveled as well a lot together, and I translated his presentations, and we traveled quite all around the world together, and we started as well projects together where I would have told him, because I was already by then traveling to more countries than he did, I would motivate him, Werner, we need as well solutions which are compatible for nations where there is no avalanche forecast and there is no given avalanche danger degree, because with the initially quite European Alp-centric focus, some of his methods, in particular the reduction method, which is a little bit the godfather of many of the other reduction methods which have been published afterwards. One input variable, an important input variable, was of course the danger potential. And it was based on the idea that the forecast would give you already a pretty good idea where we are at, and afterwards there was some approach to verify that in the terrain. But for the many, many countries which did not have an avalanche forecast by then, and by then we were in 95, so for example, no one in Scandinavia had an avalanche forecast. I remember we taught a course together for the Norwegian Mountain Guide Association at the research station of the Norwegian Geotechnical Institute close to Strun. And it was a very long bus ride. And on the bus ride back to Oslo, I told Werner, now we just must start. There needs to be a systematic approach to come to an avalanche danger degree on the regional scale when you are simply a mountain guide and you cannot afford to do all the snow pits which are necessary to do MISTA. That was one of his projects, which some of you might remember. We need an approach where coming in from the regional level, going then down finally to the zonal level, step by step, from factors which you can observe without doing dozens of snow pits, we need to systematize an approach. And that was a little bit the birth hour of NivoCheck, and today it is a very well-known tool. You can have a NivoCheck as an app on your phone, and it's a very systematic approach where someone on the level of an Alpine Club tour leader or WIMLA international mountain leader, and of course foremost an IFMGA mountain guide, really can do a regional forecast, and when they master the tool well and have been well trained in it, when you have a course with 50, 60 participants, at the end they differ not more than half of a danger degree, which I think is quite a good result. Yes, for sure. Back to your question, Werner and I have a very long-standing friendship. We are still frequently in touch with each other, and it was, it formed as well a little bit how I look at certain things like risk management and risk perception, and in particular, risk perception is still a topic, I think, It's ultimately important. And when I think about what is in the bigger picture really our task, it's always making sure that these millions of ski tourers worldwide today, they are able to make informed decisions. If in the end they decide to do a riskier or a less riskier tour, I don't really think this is our task. With one exception, and now comes the big thing, you need to be sure that it was a truly informed decision. And the truly informed decision requires that the risk perception is really well founded, that they are not fooled by randomness in the way that they believe if an event has an occurrence of 1 in 150,000 or 1 in 100,000, it's anyway never them. And we worked together with some other experts like Christensen from Norway or Dale Atkins from the US on several of these risk perception papers, where under other, and I still present these studies to almost all young mountain guide training classes, where you really show them what it means to accumulate hundreds and thousands of ski touring days a year. And you suddenly realize why about 1 in 40 mountain guides die over their professional lifetime from an avalanche event. And looking at my own experience, 5 to 6 of my former participants die every year. And I have a very good photographic memory of my former participants. I have a terrible name memory, but I have an excellent photographic memory. And when I hear again, you know, about the deadly accident with one of my former participants, I often quickly look up who it was, and I often remember as well a little bit how they did in the course and what kind of personalities they were and so on. And the thing I always really hope is that they made as well an informed decision on the residual risk tolerance. And I think this is one of the very hard things. Because otherwise, I think we have become very far, and we are on a very good level to make sure that people don't make stupid decisions.
Yeah, cool. Thanks, Manuel, for these very nice insights. Maybe some other mentors you would like to mention aside from Werner. And the question I have is, why then Avalanche Rescue? So everything which is highly connected to you has to do with Avalanche Rescue. And how does an electronics technician, as you are fundamentally, ends up in the world of this avalanche rescue things? Can you give us some insights there?
Look, there are obviously certain problems we have to solve where there is a component of technology to it. And avalanche rescue is one of it. There would be other fields like remote sensing. And very early in these Armed Forces Base courses, I realized that some of the rules and systems and methods they taught us by then simply were wrong. Because on one day you could find everything perfectly, and on the other you didn't. And as I already had a pretty good understanding of electromagnetism and so on, I really realized something must be wrong. And I started to develop completely on the side the first search strategies. And I remember, I think I published the first one, 95, in the Swiss Alpine Club magazine. And by then I really thought this is something, a publication in the Swiss Alpine Club magazine. One day later, someone called me very angry from Alpine Rescue Switzerland and gave me big shit about this young boy who is not even 20, looks like a 12-year-old, doesn't come, fourth generation from a Zermatt mountain guide family, isn't part of the rescue system, and makes a Swiss Alpine Club magazine publication about avalanche rescue. It was a disaster. And they were very powerful. And I didn't teach a single course in Switzerland for many, many years. And I didn't teach a single course for the Swiss mountain rescue system until 1 year ago. So, you know, when you are an individual who is quite creative, innovative, and you are then often not part of a large organization, which gives you as well the freedom to move very quickly, very internationally, often you create some jealousy as well, really jealousy. I'm sorry that I need to say it. But anyway, I moved on very quickly. I was in the first few years much closer connected to prevention than to rescue. But quite soon, based on these early publications, I got some consulting requests for avalanche transceivers, helped then to develop the first digital analog device, basically a device who didn't only take advantage of the higher user friendliness of the digital world, but still incorporated the unique advantages of the reliability of having access to the analog raw data. And I remember the first day I went to this very first meeting. I had everything written down on a A4 paper sheet, and things like the group check function, which is today part of every avalanche rescue transceiver. We started right there, and it is still a little bit a miracle to myself. Why? It needed an electronic engineer in 2006 to increase the efficiency of snow shoveling by 50%. They have shoveled snow for hundreds of years. And many of these people are very proud to be true practitioners. And some of them even didn't appreciate very much that there was suddenly an electronic engineer who told them how to hold the shovel and how to move the snow. But we did it, and strange enough, it's probably the most life-saving strategy which I have developed together with Ragnhild Eide, who was very active together with me in the first few years. And when we look today, over all these years back, and we analyze a little bit the huge increase of successful companion, but as well organized rescue missions, then yeah, we realize it was in a certain way worth it, and I think we are quite convinced it has saved a triple digit amount of lives, and we were able to really look at every aspect of it through these digging projects. We realized the material, the equipment, the tools are not so good yet. That triggered then the development of standards, of product standards for avalanche rescue equipment, for example, certified probes and shovels. So there is the aspect of material science, there's the aspect of electronics, there's the aspect of emergency mountain medicine. There is, of course, as well the aspect of how to convey that efficiently to 32 nations with 32 different cultures, different learning cultures, different teaching cultures, and so on.
Yeah, Manuel, now we touched a variety of different topics in what you have said, and I would go a little bit back and ask again very direct, what is your favorite innovation you invented or you influenced, and why is that? So I heard that's mainly the shoveling, but maybe there is something you really put all your love inside there and wanted to put all your emotions, but also your innovativity to develop that thing. And on the other side, I would also love to know what is one of the things you loved a lot but did not fly, and why was that?
When I think about your question again, I would say the creation of Avalife as a really multidisciplinary tool, which starts with modules of search and rescue, then go include as well the entire medical treatment aspect, but include as well the organizational aspect and the resource management to really provide greatest good for the greatest number. That was a very important and I think as well a very influential project. And maybe back to Christopher's previous question, which I really didn't answer. Where did I fail? I really did fail that my dream with mountainsafety.info was that I create a very small organization in which I would take the worldwide roof organizations who represent the main user groups, guiding, rescue, alpine clubs, and like this, we could stay very slim, very little organizational overhead, and it would all work. But then all these political complexities came into play. And I have to admit today that this approach failed. And it led to the fact that we simply picked from each big user group the players which share the spirit of innovation, of true international collaboration, of openness to other ideas, of an evidence-based approach, and people who are as well, I hate to say it, but who are as well nice to work with and nice with each other. And we have become, as mountainsafety.info, really a pool where typical subject matter experts feel very welcome and like to contribute their time to, because often in these very large international organizations, they hate this political component, because most true subject matter experts are completely non-political people. They live for the true passion in what they are best at. And we have become a pool of true subject matter experts, which unfortunately left a little bit the political aspects, which you simply cannot completely set aside to myself. I'm not too passionate in it either, but we think there is a way forward.
You mentioned that you encountered a lot of resistance when when you try to implement different strategies, different ideas into the community, especially also at the beginning when you were still very young, you looked very young. How did that change you personally, and what were strategies you used to succeed? Because you never went away from your path, right? So what were your strategies there?
As you remember a little bit earlier on the talk, first publication, next morning, 5 after 8, I got the phone call. You are not eligible to make a publication about mountain rescue. So I understood very early, either I'm able to prove everything to the last digit after the comma, or I will never succeed. And in all these 30 years, I never had hierarchical power. I was never working for an institution where, you know, showing up with the jacket with a certain logo on it would already bring you all the credibility on its own. And pretty much independently what you say, they believe you. I never had this comfort for the good or for the bad. So from the very start on, I knew I need to strictly build on an evidence-based approach. I need to do field tests. I need to analyze statistical data. I need to do laboratory testing. And only like this, I could gain the trust of the different user groups and organizations. And look, at the early ages of ICAR and UIAA and so on, in their pioneer times, they were all very much like myself. But today, all these big organizations, say if it is the European, if it is Association of Avalanche Warning Services or Rescuers or Alpine Clubs, they have a long history. Their representatives, to the big part, made a long hierarchical career in their home organizations. Their political and strategical leaders, who often have already quite a distance to the real practical application, and they take political decisions you take as high-level hierarchical leaders, and someone completely free-float like little Manuel is the most inconvenient thing for them, because they couldn't really take me under control, because I still had the comfort that I could earn enough money to drive the research forward without being dependent on research money. And what stayed as a disadvantage is, you know, when you do that in such a way I had to do it, you need to prove everything 4 times. And that obviously as well limits the forward speed. When you have to write 4 papers to prove something where others just need to say 1 sentence because, you know, they come from a respected organization, it obviously makes things hard. But on the other hand, I think a big part of the success of mountainsafety.info is as well that people do know that it is evidence-based. And look, there are not many topics in mountain safety-related fields where one has reached such a broad worldwide consensus like in avalanche rescue. And this is simply based on the fact that we decided very early, based on what I have lived through in my previous life, forget expert consensus, because expert consensus, first of all, is subjective, and second of all, means a lot of unproductive fighting for nothing. So we committed ourselves, look, if there is a disagreement, if she should go left or right or straight ahead, if we should take version 27, 31B or 35, we created together a proper study. And we carried out the study together. We looked for statistical evidence. We did a field test together. And at the end, we all stood behind these results and went forward from them. It's a harder way. And I would really wish that the large players and the institutional players would recognize that in the end, this is what we all should do, because this is, I think, the only really defendable way. And in most other professional fields, there is not even a discussion if it should be evidence-based or expert consensus. And in certain or in many risk domains, it is even enforced by law that you cannot apply procedures which are only based on expert consensus.
Thanks, Manuel. So you talked now a lot about the different worlds and the subject matter experts. So you experienced different learning cultures and different discussion cultures around the world. Can you give us maybe a little bit of an overview on your experiences on that? So with other words, who is more stubborn? Bavarians or Tyrolean course attendees, or is that someone in Canada?
If you teach for 3 decades or more, you need to have a very genuine passion for the human being, for the teaching, for being able to explain something complex to an audience which includes people with very basic to no education at all. And at the same time, you have a PhD physicist. And no one should feel that it's either completely over the top or it's completely boring. And to hold all that together in teaching in 32 countries, it has always been a positive challenge for me as well, this contact with the audience to create a certain tension, a positive tension of interest, but as well of mutual respect with the audience and these different cultures, and to use this channel you build up with these people you teach, and when there is this channel of trust, you can teach them very efficiently, and of course you learn as well for them very very many things, what their problems are in their countries, that helps them as well in the future developments. When I develop something today, I always think a little bit back of the different problems and challenges in 32 countries, and you always think, oh, but this isn't compatible to that, and so on. So it is really a multifactorial enrichment I wouldn't want to miss. And look, in the end, I think most cultures have their positive sides and have as well some more problematic sides. And I always try to get the best out of it. There are, for example, many instructors from the Northern Hemisphere, so let's say from the more Anglo-Saxon and German-speaking countries, who are not very passionate about these very typical Latin cultures, where there is obviously a certain higher chaos factor and so on. And but I always saw that as a positive challenge. I interact very well as well in the South American countries, because on one hand, yes, you have certain cultures have a little bit higher level of entropy of sorts, which you might perceive as chaos. But then on the other hand, they have as well an absolute ultimate passion potential. And when you can work your way around of their higher chaos factor, but then use their true passion when you are able to fascinate them, at the end, the result is very similar. And when I look back to the trainer programs to 27 nations, and I'm not only looking at what they teach, but I really look with what skill set do these participants leave, then I realize it is very similar, and that's very important for me. And one thing I never did as an educator with these different cultures is I never was able to fascinate for me to just entertain the people. As well, infotainment is something I quite despise. I think if you are really a good and passionate educator, you can afford to really teach people things and not just to entertain them. And in every course and every evening lecture, even when it is already late, when you are able to fascinate people and to project an energy into the audience until 11 o'clock at night, that they really stay completely awake and passionate by what you teach them, it doesn't need to be entertaining. And I as well always respect my audience, and I always think of them, they are capable to do things. They're not stupid. I totally disbelieve, for example, with this saying, keep it simple, stupid, in the teaching and the course world. I think it's an unproductive, disrespectful approach. When you are good as an educator and you are passionate, and when you design your systems, your methods, your strategies in a clever pedagogical, didactical way, then a very high percentage of everyone is able to do that, because you find a creative way to make them understand how your algorithm or whatever it is works, and to make it apply them. If it is a more theoretical or a more artisanal thing, you get there.
We had the pleasure this season to be attendees of your courses, and it was really nice to see how passionate and entertaining your courses are, and your method of teaching is. And it was really nice to, it's generally a good experience for us to have you in our team. To come back to the initial question of your ski touring setup, what is an atypical item, Manuel, you have in your day pack when you're skiing in the backcountry? An item not everybody has, but you consider as being very important, maybe?
Here I would really have to think a while, because I'm quite, I'm much more improvised. I'm much more improvised in my life than the impression might be from the very systematic approach of my systems. Because you see, when you do small science, you cannot afford, like in Blue Sky Research, to throw a couple of millions at every single different option. So a lot of small science, like what I do, like what we do at mountainsafety.info, it's very much based on the entropy of sorts. And you're basically fishing, of course, with certain systematic approaches in the entropy of sorts. And the greater the entropy of sorts, the more creativity potentially is coming out of it. So I'm in my background, the background story is has much more entropy and as well a little bit chaos than you anticipate. So I have taught many avalanche courses in jeans because I simply forgot to pack the ski pants or whatever. And, you know, then these participants of this IFMGA Mountain Guide organization ask you, Manuel, are you always teaching your courses in jeans? And, you know, when I pack for a 2 weeks trip abroad, I usually start packing about maximum half an hour before the postal bus leaves, and then I still need to run down to the bus station for about 3.5 minutes not to miss the bus. And therefore, the content of the backpack is maybe not so strategically sought out, which somebody would think of Manuel Genswein.
But we were thinking that you approach every problem or every issue you have to solve with the airport approach.
Yes, look, in the big picture, there is a certain systematic approach. What I maybe really have with me, yes, now I remember, because I teach in so many situations, I often have a huge set of adapters with me, some of them even in my backpack, because, you know, sometimes you really arrive and at your final destination and you only have your backpack because everything else is lost somewhere and sent to the southern hemisphere instead of the northern hemisphere or vice versa. And then it takes a few days to sort it out, especially because usually, you know, I'm not teaching in the capital, 30 minutes away from the major airport, but somewhere in the middle of nowhere. So in this backpack or in my office bag, there's almost everything it needs to survive and teach a course for about a week. And therefore, everything which makes a life internationally compatible, I probably have in this backpack. And often, you know, I need to show an ID somewhere. And the first thing I take out of the top pocket of my backpack is the passport. And people look at me, because they think, what? Nobody has ever shown me as a piece of ID here in the mountain hut a passport. But in my life, at least 4 or 5 times a month, you go to the airport and you need the passport. And therefore, there are certain things which for most people are seldomly used objects, and I use them in my daily life. And there are other things which are the most normal object in normal life, and I don't even know that they exist. Or like in these days, a little bit of a cough, I have a whole collection of different products so that the voice doesn't die. Because if in my professional activity I lose the voice, it's a huge risk. Then I'm really done. If I can't speak anymore, they don't understand me, I can't teach. So I always have a set with all the products it needs when you are about to lose the voice, to make sure that it doesn't happen, because it's one of the major risks of my occupational activity.
So cool. In your touring backpack, we find some adapters, lots of wallets and monies, And of course, something against cuff, which is really atypical, I guess, for most of the ski touring backpacks. Thanks, Manuel, for this nice conversation. I enjoyed it a lot to hear all the stories about different cultures, different mentors, and your life.
Thank you also from my side, Manuel, for this nice conversation. And
thank you very much to both of you. Thank you very much for allowing me to share as well this year here in the Tyrol to bring our common projects and visions another step further forward. Thanks a lot.
This episode has come to an end. Thank you for listening. The episode was produced by Wes Gregg. Music credit goes to Gravy, and the artwork was created by Mike Tia. Visit us on social media at The Avalanche Hour Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. Subscribe, rate, and review the show on whatever podcast platform you're listening on, and tell a friend. Stay safe, ski well, and have fun. And hear from us next time when we are back with another episode from the Austrian Association for Snow and Avalanches.